Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now on Last Call, just when you thought it was over, is inflation about to heat up again? Two investors say, yeah, and they're here. The Bitcoin boom, a new record, then a steep sell-off. Anthony Scaramucci here on how to own and trade the crypto. With Super Tuesday upon us, could the stock market predict who's going to win in November? We've got some numbers you're going to want to see. A surprise new bill taking aim at TikTok. Will the China-owned app actually be banned in the U.S.? The SEC ruling on a controversial climate proposal. Critics call it a wolf in sheep's clothing. And a flying car. Yep, a flying car. It's real. And we're going to show it to you. All that and more over the hour. So put your tray tables and seat backs in the locked and upright position, because Last Call is up right now. Hi, everybody. Good evening here on the East Coast. Good afternoon out West. I'm Brian Sullivan. All that and more on the big show today. But first up on Last Call, it was a not so super Tuesday for your money. The Dow dropped 400 points. Worst day in 3 weeks. S&P slipped 1% after hitting a new intraday high. But it was the Nasdaq that took most of the beating. It notched its worst day in a month. Tech stocks got pretty clobbered today. Case in point, the Nasdaq 100 had its worst day since late October. And it actually, at one point, almost broke its streak of 88 trading days without a 2% decline. It did not end below that, so that streak lives, but not a good day. No surprise that the biggest company in the world also got hammered. Microsoft fell more than 3%, worst performance in more than 4 months. Tesla saying, hold my beer. It fell more than 4% today. Tesla now 40% off this year's highs. So what dragged the market down? Well, probably a lot of things, like every day. But maybe no bigger story inside the market than Apple. Apple stock tumbling more than 5% since yesterday. That is Apple's worst two-day drop since all the way back in September. And Apple has now fallen 15% from this year's highs. Apple slipped on the back of a report from Counterpoint Research suggesting that iPhone sales in China plunged 24% year-on-year in the first 6 weeks of the year. That dismal number comes as Apple faces growing competition from a China-made rival from Huawei. Let's get reaction now on Apple, the big tech sell-off, and what it all means. Joining us now, Wedbush Managing Director Dan Ives. Dan, what happened to Apple today? What's happening to Apple?
Look, it's been a white-knuckle period because of China. I mean, as we know, China, that's 20% of iPhone demand. And we're seeing, look, we're here in Asia. I mean, we've definitely seen softness around China and in and around in terms of discounts coming out of the near. And look, in my opinion, this is a near-term turbulence period. But on the other side, you have a massive pent-up demand in terms of the upgrade cycle, 270 million iPhones. You have AI finally coming to Cupertino. We view this as a buying opportunity. Been here before, but clearly it's some dark days that they're getting through in terms of China.
Despite the fact that most China or most Apple products are made by Foxconn in China, the fact that the Chinese government has effectively banned government employees, which is millions of people, from using iPhones for at least their job role, it seems like Apple has a huge target on its back in its second largest market, despite the fact that it must spend hundreds of millions or billions on manufacturing. It all seems strange.
Look, they're the second biggest employer in China at peak iPhone cycle. So it comes down to from a supply perspective in terms of how important they are. When it comes to the demand side, look, they do have a bullseye on their back. But we've been here before. We think they get through it. I remember 4 years ago, the same type thing. You have 200 million iPhones install base in China. This will yet again grow. despite right now, I mean, sentiment, it's a piling on effect. We view this as a buying opportunity. I think a year from now, the stock's materially higher.
I'm going to say a bad word, commodity. And I say that because do you have any worry at all, Dan, that Apple, which, by the way, makes amazing computers, the Vision Pro looks fantastic, Apple TV is cool, but they live and die mostly by the iPhone. Do you worry that the iPhone is being seen or viewed by investors as a commodity-type product?
Yeah, Brian, I think it's a great point. But we've been here, we've seen this before over the years in terms of viewed as a commodity. But there's 2.2 billion reasons it's not a commodity. It's because of that install base. The iOS install, that's the golden install base of Cupertino. That's the reason that we remain firmly bullish on this, because it's about services. That's a big part of the re-rating. And it's the install base. And now AI is coming to Cupertino. I think to sell this stock ahead of that would be, you know, not just the wrong move, maybe historically wrong move relative to where we see this going.
What is Apple's role in AI?
Well, we believe on two fronts. I think they're going to introduce a WWDC in June, the start of an AI app store, which will be a separate app store, AI apps within the ecosystem. That's going to be significant from a services business. And then the big one, the drum roll, they're going to incorporate AI into iPhone 16 from an LLM. And I think when you look at that, that install base with AI, I view Apple where Meta was 18 months ago, whereas we know the New York City cab driver was bearish on Meta back then.
At the peak of its trough, I guess. That's an oxymoron, but I think you know what I meant. Remaining bullish on Apple, sees it as a buying opportunity. Dan Ives of Wedbush. Dan, really appreciate it. Have a good night.
Thank you.
All right, so we kind of hinted around about it, but let's take a look at what happened inside the market today. We showed you the macro numbers. Your stud and dud, well, the big winner of the day was Target. Target rose 12% today. They launched a new paid membership program, $49 a year. Investors like that and the results. The big decliner in the S&P was lithium miner Albemarle. Albemarle fell 18%. The company is raising money. Shareholders are worried about being diluted. Keep in mind, Albemarle, if you're not familiar with them, they're America's biggest lithium miner. Lithium is supposed to power the EV revolution. Albemarle is now 66% off its highs of less than 2 years ago. Albemarle, certainly a stock to watch. All right, given the markets today, let's give you a quick check on futures. And we are a little bit higher, not indicating the sell-off will continue. A little bit in the green for futures. All right, we are just getting our motor running here on Last Call. And up next, Bitcoin going bonkers, slamming a new high and then getting slammed. Anthony Scaramucci is here to explain what's going on. Plus, a shock new bill that could forever ban TikTok in America. It's bipartisan. We'll tell you about it coming up.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
All right, let's get to tomorrow's news tonight. Some of the headlines you and Wall Street will be talking about tomorrow morning. And first up, Nordstrom earnings are out. Now, they did beat sales expectations, but the forecast disappointed for the year ahead. Nordstrom also announcing plans to open new smaller Nordstrom Rack stores. Shares of Nordstrom crushed right now, down 9.5%. On the flip side is CrowdStrike. CrowdStrike is surging right now. The cybersecurity firm posted strong fourth quarter earnings after the bell and announced they'd be buying cybersecurity startup Flow Security. Terms of that deal not disclosed. Shares of CrowdStrike up a stunning 23%. If you own them, congrats. All right, staying with cybersecurity news, we've got an update on the recent UnitedHealth ransomware attack, and it's pretty fascinating. Eamon Javers is here. Eamon, what do we know?
Yeah, Brian, you're just talking about CrowdStrike, and this comes to us from CrowdStrike. There is a new twist now to what had been a fairly standard story of ransomware disruption after the cyber attack on United Healthcare's Change Healthcare subsidiary that happened back on February 21st. And now a devious double cross may have taken place here, putting United Healthcare's money at risk. Now, the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike tells CNBC that the most likely scenario is that through a series of murky interactions on the dark web, an attempt by United Healthcare to pay a $22 million ransom has been intercepted. That means United Healthcare may be out the $22 million payment, and the original hacker may still be in possession of their data. United Healthcare has not publicly said whether or not it attempted to make that ransom payment. Now, the way ransomware as a service operates is hackers use platforms developed by separate groups of criminals to conduct their attacks. Victims send their payments to the hacking service providers, who take a cut, and then they send the remainder on to the original hacker. Now, in this case, CrowdStrike says it appears that the ransomware as a service vendor, known as ALF-V, has simply pocketed the United Healthcare payment without sending it along to the original hacker, who goes by the name Nachi M. CrowdStrike says it sees pleas on the dark web from Nachi M to ALF-V, demanding to know what happened to the money, saying in Russian, quote, "Bro, who is taking the money? Did you scammed us? Why?" Now, to make matters more confusing, CrowdStrike says ALF-V has posted a fake law enforcement takedown banner on its dark web site, making it appear as if the authorities have shut down the criminal site. In reality, though, CrowdStrike says it looks like those hackers just took the money and ran, Brian. A spokesperson for United Healthcare told CNBC's Bertha Coombs today, "We are focused on the investigation and restoring operations at Change." And of course, bear in mind with all of this that all the criminals involved here they're con men, they're liars. It's difficult to take anything they say at face value, but that appears to be the twisted saga of what's going on in the dark web.
So it's not funny, but it's kind of funny in a sense that the hackers, the criminals who demanded the money, are like mad that they got ripped off.
Yes, they got conned. The hackers got conned and United Healthcare got conned, if this is the correct scenario, right? Because United Healthcare would have tried to make this payment, sending along the cryptocurrency to a wallet address, and then somebody in the middle of the transaction just takes the money and goes. The original hackers never get their money either. So everybody is mad in this whole scenario, and you just don't know what happened to the ALF-V group who allegedly would have taken this money in this scenario.
Somebody call Robert Redford and write up the sting too. Eamon Javers,
thank you. Yep.
All right, next up, Bitcoin's wild ride. You've got to see this, okay? You probably were working all day. Maybe you didn't follow Bitcoin all day long. That's our job. So Bitcoin started the day going up, up, up. It hit a new intraday high, all-time high, 69,210, right around 10 a.m. Eastern. But then Bitcoin began to sell off, and then it sold off some more and some more. At one point, falling below 60,000 for an intraday swing of over $9,000 or about 14%, its biggest move in a year and a half. And this is kind of, dare we say, random but interesting. Our CNBC research team found that since spot prices began to be recorded, Bitcoin is up a cool 70 million% since 2010. I repeat, 70 million%. Might explain all those new mansions around Lake Tahoe and the Hamptons. Now, as we have discussed, the recent rally lifting crypto-related stocks. But as Bitcoin surged and then tumbled today, the stocks followed suit. Names like MicroStrategy, Coinbase, Marathon Digital, and CleanSpark all closed way down. So what is really driving this Bitcoin roller coaster on a ride that's always been a roller coaster? Let's bring in somebody who's been around a lot of crypto's highs and lows and tears. That is Anthony Scaramucci, founder of Skybridge Capital. Anthony, I get that Bitcoin is volatile. It's always been volatile. But a $9,000 move in 4 hours, even for Bitcoin, that seems bonkers.
Okay, but I want to take you back to 2021, the lead up. And so you had Bitcoin correct 10% or more 13 times on the March in 2021 from 3,800 to 69,000. And so this is the first big correction. I guess one of the other things we should be talking to people about is that it's a 50% move from the beginning of the year or since the inception of the ETF. So at some point, it would had to have had a correction. Now, it turns out because you can detect these wallets and you can see what's moving on the Bitcoin blockchain, it looks like some wallets had released Bitcoin that were mined in 2010. So a big whale out there decided to dump his Bitcoin into the market at the same time as the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust is dumping because of the high fees associated with it. And so, Brian, those two things caused the dip, but you know, Bitcoin's got a bid again tonight. I have a bit clock in front of me. It's trading 63,727 or thereabout. So it did bounce off of 59. And you know this because you know you're a technical guy like me. You get to a high that hasn't been reached in 2 years, you could see a flood of sellers there on an interim basis. So I don't read too much into this. And I'll say to you that what will surprise Bitcoiners is it getting through the all-time high prior to the halving, which is in April, probably April 20th of this year. So listen, if we get through that the all-time high before the halving, that will also be historic because that hasn't happened in the 15 years of Bitcoin's since Bitcoin's inception.
And I know you called for Bitcoin 170K or more, depending on where it is, because every time it halves, it tends to go up 4X from that. But can I ask probably a dumb question, Anthony, because, and I'm asking for myself, I'll be perfectly blunt, because you got to admit what you don't know, and this can be confusing, right? So if there's a stock and a stock starts to go up, and some hedge fund hates the stock, and they start to short the stock during the market. You know, they can bully it around. You got buyers, you got sellers. I get Bitcoin has buyers and sellers like everything else, but how are the mechanics of Bitcoin different than an equity? You know, you can short the turd out of an equity. How does Bitcoin get sold so quickly, given its mechanism is so different? Am I making sense?
Yes, no, you're making a lot of sense, but the stock that I would refer people to is Tesla, something that many of the viewers and listeners of CNBC know well. There were tons of shorts in Tesla with Tesla's march upward, and there was lots of oscillation. If you want to go way back, and I'll date myself back into the early 2000s, we watched Amazon go from $116 to $10, and people were calling for the death of Amazon, and of course, Amazon became one of the most successful companies in human history. So this is still immature. To your point, we don't have the options, derivative markets. Those options and derivatives on the Bitcoin ETFs have yet to be approved by the SEC. So we do have high margin over-the-counter instruments that are being used by brokers in the Bitcoin market, but those are sloppy and they're inefficient. So you probably need 6 or 12 more months of stabilization. And let me just make this last point. We have 5% adoption of Bitcoin globally. That puts us right about March of 1999, if you were comparing it to Web 1. So I just want you to think about what happened from Web 1, 1999, to where we are today, 25 short years later. And if you stay patient with Bitcoin and you have it appropriately sized in your portfolio, so you're not looking at these oscillations, I think you'll be well rewarded. And, you know, listen, SkyBridge and SkyBridge clients, despite a lot of guff that I took over the last 2 years, have frankly been very well rewarded by this in the last 3 or 4 months.
Been quite the run, and we appreciate you coming on to talk about it. All some of the mechanisms, kind of to your point, still it's new, but it's not new. Bitcoin's been just around a while, but now it's growing up. It's
just want to keep my hair, Brian. I'm just trying to keep my hair through a very volatile market.
Too late for some of us. Anthony, thank you very much. All right, still ahead. Can the stock market predict the outcome of the presidential election? We have got some numbers you got to see and hear next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
It's time for a Super Tuesday RBI because with everybody else talking about politics, let's kind of CNBC it and talk about politics and your money because like it or not, they're definitely related. Carson Group's Ryan Dietrich pulled out some pretty amazing stats about markets and elections. Here's what he found. In the three-month run-up to the presidential election, how the S&P 500 does seems to pick the winner for the White House. Not all the time, but most of the time. In fact, in 20 of the 24 elections since 1928, if the S&P 500 is higher in August, September, and October, the incumbent has won. Or if the market is down in those 3 months, the challenger tends to win the White House. In fact, there have only been four times where the market went one way and the election went the other way. Here they are. In 1956, the S&P 500 fell 3 months or 3% in the 3 months before the election. But Dwight D. Eisenhower was reelected. 1968, the market rose about 4%, but Richard Nixon beat Hubert Humphrey and independent George Wallace. Now, to be fair, Lyndon Johnson did not run for reelection that year, but we digress. In 1980, the S&P 500 soared 6.9% in the 3 months leading up to the vote, but Mr. Ronald Reagan crushed Jimmy Carter. And then it took 40 years for the next time to happen. In fact, the S&P squeaked out a 0.1% gain, but it was up. But that was not enough to prevent a guy named Joe Biden from winning the White House. Now, obviously, we've got a few months to go. It'll feel like years. But we have a few months to go until this little historical time frame kicks in. But just kind of tuck those numbers in the back of your mind as the market makes big gains now. We'll see what happens in the 3 months leading up to the election. Certainly random, but interesting. Staying with D.C.-related news, a bipartisan group of lawmakers putting forward a harsh message for TikTok. A new bill says TikTok parent company ByteDance needs to either spin off TikTok or face pretty much a ban in the United States. CNBC's Emily Wilkins joining us now with the latest. Emily, what exactly is being proposed here?
Well, hey, Brian. Well, yeah, yet again, TikTok is in the crosshairs of Congress. And so this new bipartisan bill basically ultimately either forces TikTok to break off from parent company ByteDance or essentially bans the video app in the U.S. Now, the bipartisan bill has two components. One, it would make it illegal for an app controlled by China or another foreign adversary country from being distributed in the U.S. through app stores or web hosting services. The legislation also empowers the president to designate apps owned by certain countries as a national security risk, provided the app meets certain guidelines spelled out in the bill. Now, if the measure becomes law, TikTok would have a little less than 6 months to divest from ByteDance or be blocked in the U.S. Mike Gallagher, the chairman of the Select Committee investigating the Chinese Communist Party, said in a statement that America's foremost adversary has no business controlling a dominant media platform in the United States. TikTok's time in the United States is over unless it ends its relationship with CCP-controlled ByteDance. TikTok CEO Shou-Zi Chew appeared for a contentious hearing last year in front of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Now that same committee is going to be marking up the new legislation on Thursday, and Brian will be keeping a close eye on that.
It's a big one. Emily Wilkins in D.C. Emily, thank you very much. All right, joining us now to talk about it further is former North Dakota Senator and University of Chicago Institute of Politics Director Heidi Heitkamp and economic analyst at the American Enterprise Institute, Jimmy Pethakoukas. Both, of course, are CNBC contributors. Senator Heitkamp, does this bill, which is bipartisan, have any chance in heck in passing?
I think absolutely. One of the things that we know is going to happen in this election cycle is trying to determine who could be more hawkish on China. This is clearly a China hawk bill, but it's also being done by very serious people with great reputations. The chairman of that committee, Congressman Gallagher, unfortunately is leaving politics, but everyone knows he's a straight shooter. And what the American public needs to understand is they know more about the threat that TikTok presents than all of us, because they've been studying it behind closed doors in a skiff. And so I think that this has a clear chance of moving forward.
Yeah, you know, listen, Jimmy, I know TikTok's got a lot of fans. People love it. A lot of businesses make money off it. We have a statement, by the way, from TikTok basically saying 170 million Americans will have their free speech, deprived of, and small businesses. There's their statement. You can read it. But people won't like this. But I think you made the analogy that this is kind of like the Soviet Union buying starting a television channel in the late 1960s in the United States that would have never been allowed. And this is, by all accounts, a foreign adversary government which has a direct line to millions, tens, hundreds of millions of Americans, many of whom are minors.
Yeah, I'm not sure we would have considered China a foreign adversary in 2000 or 2010, but I sure think a heck of a lot of Americans view them, and apparently Congress does, as a foreign adversary today. And there's certainly no way we would have allowed another foreign adversary, the Soviet Union, to, again, buy a TV station, start a TV station, and just sort of control that. There's really not a whole lot of difference between that and this. This company is controlled, as is every Chinese company, fundamentally by the government. And the government is controlled by the authoritarian, totalitarian Chinese Communist Party. To allow them free reign into the homes and computers, not just adults, but children, really seems pretty weird.
Yeah, you know, Senator, the Biden administration itself, when I called it a foreign adversary, it's not my opinion. The Biden administration itself was labeled four countries the biggest national security risk to the United States. Number one is China, followed by Russia, Iran, and North Korea. I don't understand why ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, is fighting this so much. Just move the servers to the United States, move the servers to Canada, maybe, a friendly nation where we know what's going on. But they keep pushing back on this with the PR statements. You're going to have, millions of Americans deprived of free speech. They must love the data they're getting to be so reluctant to spin this out?
That's the first question. They basically say, make no mistake about it, this is a ban on TikTok. No, it's not. It's not like what was done in Montana that basically said, shut down the app right now. This was something saying, look, we recognize we have a lot of users in this country, but you are getting sensitive information and have access to a lot of Americans, and we can't tolerate that given your history. And so I don't know why they're pushing back. I think the Montana decision, the district court decision there, basically intimated that there's a free speech problem. Quite honestly, I'm not a free speech expert, but I am a lawyer, and I don't see it. If you deny a platform, doesn't necessarily mean you're denying speech.
I will push back a little bit, Jimmy, and just say that, listen, like all things in politics, money's involved. And some of the backers, I think Congressman Gallagher and probably some others, are getting lobbying money from Google. Google is a competitor through their Shorts feature to TikTok. I think Palantir and others who deal with security. So there's definitely money on the other side as well. Do you think TikTok ultimately, through public relations, TV commercials, do they win this fight?
I really don't think so. Whether or not this bill passes, I find it hard to think that right now that the Chinese-American relationship will be better a year from now or 2 years from now. I think there's good reason it'll be worse and getting worse. And if not now, then, but maybe now.
Oh, wish was a little more reason to be optimistic, but I fear you are probably correct, my friend. Jimmy Petrakukas, yeah. Former Senator Heidi Heitkamp, both of you, thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you.
All right, coming up, is the Federal Reserve once again fueling the inflationary fire? Gordon Johnson, Adam Kobasi say yeah, and they're here next. All right, welcome back. As we mentioned earlier, Bitcoin and other speculative names have been on an epic run this year. But what is really behind the monster moves? Well, GLJ Research's Gordon Johnson has a theory. In a recent tweet, I think yesterday, he wrote that, quote, with inflation currently inflecting higher, the Fed is throwing proverbial gasoline on the inflation fire by letting the reckless excesses it printed in 2020 and 2021 to flow into private hands. Because of that, he thinks the pace of inflation is about to take off once again. Is he right? Is the Fed really kind of fueling the crypto and other stock mania? Joining us now is GLJ Research CEO and founder Gordon Johnson and the Kobesi Letters editor-in-chief, Adam Kobesi. Gordon, thanks for joining us. Start off with you. You said you're just calling balls and strikes in your tweet on inflation. You don't see inflation spiking like it did in 21, do you?
It's possible, and thanks for having me, Brian. There's been no greater engine of inequality in the U.S. than the Fed. Effectively, they're literally robbing the poor and the middle class to pay the rich. Let me explain. So what the Fed did in 2020 and 2021 is they printed literally 300 years of Fed balance sheet expansion in over a few months. And it was so much that you had excesses that they put into this reverse repo account. It was effectively the excess money they printed that was sitting dormant. And as soon as the debt ceiling was lifted last year, Yellen shifted the Treasury issuance from long duration to short duration, and that caused that reverse repo money to start to drain into private hands. And we believe that's why, because that reverse repo money is dropping, that's why you're having this massive speculation and massive increase in speculative assets. But that, keep in mind, you know this, Brian, December and November of last year, we had the biggest loosening of financial conditions ever. And that's very inflationary. So I think that's why you're seeing stocks up. That's why you're seeing Bitcoin up, other speculative assets up. And it's going to be very inflationary. So we think you could see a repeat of what we saw before.
Yeah, Adam, listen, money supply is down a couple trillion from the COVID peak, but still up about 8 trillion in about 4 or 5 years. Do you agree with Gordon's thesis?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of, theories around the RRP and what's happening with that. But I think there's also, just a lot of other indicators that are showing inflation is at least starting to flatten out right around 3 to 4%, which is still 50 to 100% above the Fed's long-term 2% target rate that they've made clear is not going to be coming down. That is their target. If you look at Case-Shiller housing inflation data recently, it shows housing inflation is at 5%. Prices in home prices in the 20 top cities in the U.S. all jumped in December year over year for the first time since November of 2022. And even super core inflation, which everybody focuses on CPI, super core inflation is even more important in my view. Which is effectively services inflation, less energy and shelter, is actually rising sharply now back to 4.5%, up from 3.8%. And that's the first jump since 2021. So I don't think we're seeing necessarily a huge surge in inflation, like back to 9 or 10%, something crazy. But I think it's been proven that getting inflation from 4% to 2% is going to be a lot more difficult than it was to go from 9 to 4. Right now, I think the Fed just can't jump the gun. They have to keep rates higher for longer, and interest rate cuts are going to keep being pushed back.
You know, Gordon, but your point on wealth inequality is well taken. Listen, obviously, we're CNBC. People know us as the stock market channel. We want people to make money. We like when the stock market goes up. I get all that. But at the same time, to your point, real incomes are down. Inflation, even if you got a raise, in your lower end of the spectrum, inflation has probably taken away more of your real spending power than any kind of a wage increase that you might have gotten. I mean, how bad do you see wealth inequality getting? I mean, because we hear a lot about it politically, but it just keeps going up.
Yeah, I just think the Fed is making a huge mistake again, Brian. Let me explain. So coming into last year, right, March of 2023, the market was pricing in two rate cuts. What did we get? We got 3 rate hikes after that point. So complete opposite of what the market was expecting. So you would have thought the stocks would have fell, stock market would have fell, crypto would have sold off. No, we had a record surge in stocks, a record surge in crypto. What does that tell you? And Brian, you know this well. That tells you the Fed's current policy is not restrictive at all. Think about it. We have 5.8% nominal GDP growth in Q4. We have record corporate bond issuance in January. Corporations are telling you these rates are so low, they're chomping at the bit to lock them in. You have multi-decade low savings rates, despite the fact you're getting 4 to 5% on those savings highest in decades. So consumers are telling you we're not saving. The setup right now is for a resurgence in inflation. And I'll highlight on the super core CPI, the 4% number highlighted, that's on a year-over-year basis. You annualize the month-over-month basis, you're talking about around 8%. The number exploded off the charts. If you look at these month-over-month numbers, inflation is inflecting higher. So keep in mind, the Fed focuses on the Fed funds rate. What's important are market rates, U.S. Treasury rates. And when the Fed increases their Fed funds rate, then 10 minutes later, Powell gets on, goes to the presser and talks about he's going to be cutting rates. He completely dilutes, the effect of that Fed funds rate hike. So I just think that they're making a massive mistake. I think we're going to see a resurgence in inflation. And that's why we believe interest rates are going to go significantly higher this year.
Wow. And Adam, I mean, I would guess the Fed probably wants to err more on the side of slowing the economy than seeing inflation tick up again.
Yeah, I mean, look, Brian, I've said this on your show many times before, and we've been saying this to our subscribers for months, if not years now. I think the Fed would rather keep interest rates too high for too long and risk a period of economic weakness than cut too soon and risk a resurgence of inflation, which would pretty much destroy consumer confidence. It would make long-term inflation expectations even harder to get under control. And even right now, I mean, look, growth expectations are rising. You see pretty strong economic data all around the board. I don't see a situation where the Fed looks to just start cutting rates rapidly, especially if they think we're on track for a soft landing. Maybe they think we can weather the storm a little bit more and just keep rates higher for longer and play it safe.
We'll see. Adam Kobesi, Gordon Johnson, good discussion. Good takes. Thanks, guys. Thank you. All right, coming up, the SEC voting on a controversial climate change rule, but is it going to go way too far? Former SEC Chair Jay Clayton will join us next. All right, time now for bonus TNT. Former President Donald Trump holding a meeting with Tesla CEO Elon Musk over the weekend in Palm Beach. That, according to a new report, for the New York Times, Trump reportedly speaking with Musk about donating to his presidential campaign. Musk has not confirmed he will be donating to the Trump campaign, but a donation from the world's second richest person could be a major game changer for the former president. Next up tomorrow, the SEC is expected to issue its final ruling on a controversial climate disclosure rule. Initially proposed in March of 2022, the rule would expand investor insight into climate risks from publicly listed companies. It would require reporting on climate-related impact, risk management processes, greenhouse gas emissions, and financial statement metrics, and as well as other information about climate-related goals. The final proposal has not yet been released, but Reuters reports some disclosure requirements have been dropped or softened. Now, some publicly traded companies already offer a lot of this information in their filings, but the approval of this rule would make it mandatory for all publicly traded companies. Joining us now is former SEC chair and CBC contributor Jay Clayton. Jay, those are noble goals, right? Climate change. How much are you emitting? How much harm might you be doing to the environment? So what is the issue with this rule potentially going too far?
Thanks, Brian. Nice to be here. What is the issue? Exactly. They're very noble goals and very important goals, particularly if you believe that we are facing a climate crisis and that transition is necessary. Those are extremely profound questions that involve national security, energy policy, financial policy. And as we've seen, getting them wrong, as has what's happened in my view in Europe, can be hugely costly. And here is the SEC stepping in and not just looking at these things as they've been looked at for the past 10 years, which there is mandatory disclosure now, Brian. If you have climate risk that's material to an investment decision, you already have to disclose it. What this SEC proposal, and look, the proposal's 2 years old, did was created a whole new disclosure framework. It wasn't really about investing. It's about climate transition and climate risk more broadly. And the big issue here, Brian, in a nutshell, is that's not really the SEC's purview. It's not the SEC's expertise. And this is against a background where administrative agencies are seen by the courts and others to be greatly exceeding and testing their authority.
Yeah.
My fear is that there'll be, that there will, even though it's scaled back, the reports are that it's going to be scaled back. I have no idea how much it's going to be scaled back. This will undermine the SEC's authority going forward because the court is going to say, you've just way overstepped your bounds.
You know, listen, climate change, fighting climate change is important, and companies have to do their part. To your point, many companies, particularly those the energy side and others, already report this. And by the way, many investors might say, I'm not investing in you because you don't report this stuff and you're doing terrible due diligence and I'm out. That said, we've already seen, Jay, a 50% reduction in the number of public companies over 30 years. The number of publicly traded stocks is down by half in 30 years. And I do worry that imposing more rules like this and making mid-sized companies staff up with a bunch of people reporting on the environment is just going to make more companies say, it's not worth it to be publicly traded anymore. I can't afford it.
Well, Brian, it's already been happening. When I chaired the SEC, we made a real effort to make it easier for companies to become public. We need public companies. It is very difficult for retail investors to access other investment opportunities. Now, some people come out and say, oh, well, let's just make those other investment opportunities, you know, even harder to access or even harder. That's ridiculous. Okay. We need to make public company, being a public company, more viable, more attractive. But let me give you just my anecdotal view, Brian. Mm-hmm. When I started doing this 30 years ago, if you came to me with a company that had a market value of 100 million or more, I would probably tell you 8 out of 10 times, you know what? You're a great candidate to be a public company. Let's get your financial reporting in order. Let's upgrade what you're doing. That number, that's not 100 million now. That's a billion, 5 billion, 10 billion. And a lot of it has to do with the cost of being a public company.
Well said, because private companies just make rich people richer because they're the only ones that can access them. Jay Clayton, always appreciate
your view.
Thank you. Anytime. All right, now to our quicker than the ticker, all the best of the rest of the headlines.
Let's put 60 seconds on the clock. Worldwide outages on multiple social media platforms today. Meta's Facebook, Instagram, Threads were down for thousands of users for about 2 hours. In a statement, Meta apologized and said it was a technical issue. Google's YouTube and Gmail also experiencing service problems, but unclear what caused those. Amazon-owned Whole Foods unveiling mini markets for all you city shoppers. It's called the Whole Foods Market Daily Shop. It'll focus on prepared foods and seasonal produce. The first location opens in New York City later this year. A piece of TV history just sold on eBay. The iconic booth that the Soprano family sat in their series finale sold for $82,000. The booth's previous home was at a New Jersey ice cream shop. A bull on the loose in Florida. Look at that. A giant bull caught strolling through the middle of a neighborhood in the middle of the night. Neighbors spotted the trespasser, called the cops, and the police safely reunited the bull with its owner.
And that story is noble. All right, coming up, flying cars about to go on sale. Yep, we're talking flying cars. That's cool. Next. All right, Aleph Aeronautics is working to deliver the world's first real flying car. The company reporting that pre-orders for the $300,000 futuristic vehicle are just shy of 3,000. How exactly does this work? Joining us tonight with more is Aleph Aeronautics CEO Jim Duchovny. Jim, this is amazing. And I know we got kind of like mock-ups and some videos. How real is your car? Is it flying now?
That is correct. Thank you, Brian. So the car, which you saw on that that image, which you saw, is actually CGI, but the real car looks exactly like that. It's a full size. And yes, one of the prototypes had been flying for over 2 years. The latest prototype, which looks exactly like the picture you showed, have been flying for at least several months now.
I know there's things you can say, things you can't say, things you won't say. I get it. But I don't see any wings on this thing. Is it a helicopter?
So as when you drive, it's a regular EV. It's a regular electric vehicle. When it takes off, it's a rotorcraft. Think about, so there's a four propellers up front and four propellers in the back. That what gets you up, and what you're showing is right now, you need wings, as you correctly pointed out. So the point is, if you have expendable wings, that would be too much weight for the takeoff. So what we did is we actually reused the size of the car as the wings. So as you see right now, when the car transitions, you actually have two wings and it becomes a biplane. You can drive, you can fly without transition, or you can fly with the transition. With transition, it's just more efficient. You use energy much more efficient this way.
Looks amazing. I mean, how far could I theoretically go in this thing? How high am I going?
So the optimal, if you fly in the optimal way, you can go up to 110 miles flying or 200 miles driving. Those numbers will improve, but as of today, this is 110 miles flying or 200 miles driving.
I'm thinking about it for my commute, and it just looks fantastic. Very quickly, there's been a lot of stuff going around that basically you're backed by Elon Musk's SpaceX. You are not backed by SpaceX, correct? I just want to clear it up because you've probably seen this stuff online.
No affiliation to SpaceX at all. Never saw Elon, but definitely welcome to see him at some point. So the confusion came is because they said that investor in Tesla and SpaceX also invested.
Thank you so much. Looks amazing. I'll ride in it anytime. I'm here for you. We'll see you tomorrow night, folks.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.